This is Not Gods and Machines, a podcast from the Writing and Humanities program out of the Carver College of Medicine here at the great and wonderful University of Iowa. My name is Jason T. Lewis, hosting today. What is this podcast and what is the Writing and Humanities program? The Writing and Humanities program lives inside of the Carver College of Medicine, where myself and my colleague Dave Etler do everything from podcasting to teaching courses on literature to extracurricular lunchtime things with visual arts. We put on
ECLTs.
Extracurricular lunchtime things. Yes. As long as we make it an acronym, it is
legit.
Better. Yeah, it's totally legit.
Can you tell I've been in medical school?
That's right. Acronyms get funded better. Can somebody do a study on whether acronyms get funded better?
It has to have a really, really bad acronym title, though.
Yeah, well, okay. We'll discuss this.
I'm sorry.
At a different time. Acronym could just
next
be
week.
Acronym.
I'm the wild card.
So the thing about the Writing Humanities program and all the things that we do is we try and bring into the College of Medicine some semblance of the humanities as a discipline and giving the students opportunities to do anything from use writing and artistic endeavors for wellness to trying to inform the way that they might go on to practice medicine. And so while we have the Short Code podcast, which is a fantastic podcast that talks about the experience of medical school life and a bunch of other things, we thought we might start this podcast as a way to talk about some of this more humanities-based medicine discussion.
So deep and substantial things in contrast to Dave's usual.
Wow, that sounded a bit like a jab.
Yeah, I mean, I'm drawing no conclusions on any of these things. I'm just saying we're trying to cover our bases.
John's throwing shade.
I know. It's not Twitter, John.
If only Dave were secretly...
Dave is sitting right there.
Dave is secretly deafening me in one ear right now.
He can cut us off at any time he wants.
That's right.
Cut his mic.
Yeah.
So wait, did I just understand the title of this correctly? Is it Not Gods or Machines because... like, doctors aren't gods or machines?
Correct. That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just got that.
Yeah.
Like, a minute ago.
Yeah. Is that a reference to anything, or is that just something you came up with?
My freaking brilliance
is
what it's
right out of your brain. Right out of his brain.
Yeah. You know, that's just how it works sometimes. No, I mean, as I was trying to think about, A, what would be different about this podcast in comparison to the Short Coat. Mm-hmm. I was also trying to think about what is part of the charge of our department and what we try and do for students. Mm-hmm. And there's often that thing that happens where doctor as Superman or mm-hmm. doctor as machine or cog in a bureaucracy that right. has 15 minutes to finish the job and move on to the next widget.
15 minutes to finish the psychiatry exam, which is what I literally just came from.
Right.
Like, that was our test. We had to figure out that somebody had PTSD in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You got to just be better.
And then crank out a note about it.
Yeah. 15 minutes is not enough time.
No. Unless
you meet them in a bar.
Then
it might be enough time, but in a clinical setting, you gotta break some barriers down, I think. So that's kind of what I was thinking about when I decided to put this thing together. And we've done a couple of episodes that were sort of one-off episodes where we talked about different things. We had some interview stuff, and now I'm trying to put together how we can do recurring things. And so I thought it would be really interesting to discuss readings, writings that would then lead us into talking about some of the ways that the thematic content will help us discuss some of the stuff that you guys have experienced as medical students. So I guess that's a great time to introduce who we've got here on my immediate left. For those of you who are watching on Facebook, we have Dylan.
Or imagining.
Imagining the palatial studio in which mm-hmm. we are recording this.
Yeah, we have a great diamond table in front of us.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Everything's gold.
It's really the
best. Except the diamond table.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. It's fantastic. Uh-huh. It's the best.
Huge.
It's the best table ever. We've got Dylan Todd, who is a medical student who is now in the research phase of his MSTP, Medical Science Training Program, MD, PhD. Listen to all these acronyms that I'm throwing around. Mm-hmm. So medical doctor, but also scientist thing. So
in the pipeline.
So you guys are now fully slotted into that pipeline that runs very slowly to the other end, right? So you're in year 3 or 4, right?
Yeah, like a glacier.
Yeah,
glacier. Getting there.
Yeah, if you ever want to be a career student and want to spend 8 years of your life,
minimum,
doing medicine, then that's the degree for you.
Do it.
Okay. That's great.
Not doing medicine, learning medicine.
Yes,
and then being medicine.
Next to Dylan, we have Casey McCleary, who is in her third year of medical school.
It's true.
Just begun the clinical years, as they call them.
Oh, no, I have not. Oh, that's right. The new curriculum.
The new curriculum in which you are like 1/5 the way through.
I am 1 week away from being done with all my core clerkships, so.
All right. So there you go. Then we've got John Pienta, who has been here for, it seems like he's been here for 9 years.
Yeah, I've just... All my hair fell out.
It's right. That's right. Like
so much aging.
So much aging. And John's in his fourth year. But John's in M4. He's been here with us on the Short Code. All these guys have done the Short Code podcast. We've got Mark Terrell, who is much like Dylan, ensconced in some basement laboratory with mice.
Oh, it's or down something. The hall. Oh, it's down.
So, his has windows.
Yeah, I have
his
great windows.
That's
I
how
have
you no can windows. Tell if a lab has funding or not. How many windows?
Hey.
And so I'm Jason T. Lewis, the director of the Writing Humanities Program and host of this here podcast show. So the story that we've read today that we kind of want to talk about, and I realize that it's a little bit difficult to talk about a short story that maybe some of you have not read, but we're going to put links in the show notes so that you can go and find a copy that may or may not be legally put upon the internet, but you can read it. I always recommend going and getting the book. Raymond Carver's A Small Good Thing is actually, quite honestly, the short story that I read that cemented in my mind the idea that I wanted to be a writer. Because of what he's able to do in this story. Raymond Carver is one of the best writers of short stories that we've ever had in our great United States, died of cancer in the early 80s. And this story deals with something that's central to a lot of what you guys have been working with at the various points in your career as medical students. Spoiler alert. As we talk about this, we're going to give away things about the story. I don't think that'll really diminish the experience of the story. But what we're going to do is kind of just walk through the story, talk about key points, key thematic elements, and then use that as a jumping off point to talk about what they made us think about or consider as we were reading. My reaction to it is obviously going to be very different than you guys who are in the midst of this study of medicine. So let's do that. Let me get over here. Small Good Thing, in broad strokes, it's a story about a mother and a father and a son. Mother orders a birthday cake for her son. The day of his birthday, son is hit by a car. And I want to kind of read little parts of it.
When is the story set?
You know, the story was originally published in 1983. So I'm thinking it's probably around that time. I mean,
okay.
there are things about it, like the boy is walking to school and
orderlies.
Yeah. And I remember, like, when I read this story, I actually envision the little street that I used to walk down to get to my elementary school, mm-hmm. you know, and now children are taken to school, like, you know, in armored cars and such. but yeah, so it's set in the early 80s or late 70s, and so the boy is hit by a car, and I really want to read this piece of the story here on page one that describes how he's hit by the car. On Monday morning, the birthday boy was walking to school with another boy. They were passing a bag of potato chips back and forth, and the birthday boy was trying to find out what his friend intended to give him for his birthday that afternoon. Without looking, the birthday boy stepped off the curb and at an intersection, stepped off the curb at an intersection and was immediately knocked down by a car. He fell on his side with his head in the gutter and his legs in the road. His eyes were closed, but his legs were moving back and forth as if they were trying to climb over something. That piece of a couple of sentences right there automatically sets a certain tone for the story. It's very understated. It's very matter of fact. And it just, it describes the boy being hit by a car as being knocked down. So the stakes are kept at a certain level. And I think that's key to the thematic stuff that happens later on. So of course, the boy whose name is Scotty is rushed to the hospital.
I thought that was interesting, though, how they really didn't mention his name.
Right.
It almost seemed like they were going out of the, I mean, Carver was going out of his way not to mention his name. He just refers to him as the boy and the birthday boy, really, until he gets to the hospital, I think.
Yeah, and then he becomes a named entity.
Right.
And I think he's doing that because on one level, he wants it to remain almost more universal.
Yeah.
But then as the focus draws in on the child in the hospital and his parents start to realize the stakes of what they have to lose, he becomes more and more a very specific entity.
Right.
They stop using the name again toward the end of the story. Hmm. So, I mean, that would still fit with it, though. Like, they can't even think about him as a person. Like, they're just too overwhelmed.
Right.
And I think that's an interesting point too, because I think, you know, this feels a sort of a universal experience to me, both having been a patient, having had a child, a patient, a very sick child, a patient, and also taking care of patients in the hospital, that there is this sort of systematic incidental denaming,
right?
Where you become bed 43, you become,
right,
you know, the 16-year-old female or the 85-year-old complaining guy or whatever, you know, where
right,
you get that identity stripped. So that's an interesting juxtaposition. And I think it helps cement the role of the viewer.
Yeah. And I think that what you're describing is also sort of a coping mechanism. As Casey was saying, maybe a coping mechanism for the parents, but then also for the clinicians, a coping mechanism that one level down of depersonalization protects them emotionally. And we can have an argument about whether or not how you can protect yourself differently from becoming too emotionally involved, or whether you should at all, or anything in between. But yeah, Carver does a lot of subtextual deflection throughout the story. And I think it helps to build the themes. I mean, so of course, the boy, who we now know his name, Scotty, ends up in the hospital, and the parents are obviously distraught. They want to know what's going on. And so they're talking to the physicians, at which point the physicians are like, well, they say, what's wrong with him? And he's like, oh, you know, he's just sleeping right now. So he's in a coma. No, we're not going to call it a coma. And there's some strange interaction with the physicians and the parents and how the physicians talk to them about what's going on with their son. And I was curious to know, let me find the place here.
So while you look, I'll say, I think to some extent that's an artifact of like an older way that medicine was practiced that I think we're trying to get away from, like exactly for some of the reasons that might be clearer as we read the story. But they make a big emphasis now on being really upfront with people. Like if they don't maybe have a super good outcome or like good prognosis. Whereas I think before maybe it was like, oh, give them a little more hope and sort of shunt questions off and don't admit when you're wrong and stuff like that. Admit when you don't know.
And I wonder too, if it doesn't have something to do with 30 plus years ago, how technology was different and our ability to really pinpoint things and nail down things and give them names. It wasn't as pronounced as it is now.
Yeah. When did the CT come out?
That was right around when they were starting to move into clinical use.
Yeah.
In the early 80s.
Okay. And so they wouldn't have been widespread, most likely.
Yeah, because I was wondering, because, I mean, I don't know, did anybody else feel like they knew exactly what this kid had?
I was concerned when he didn't go to the hospital right away.
Yeah, well, when he got up and then was fine and then passed out again, like that screams epidermal hematoma.
That's what I was thinking the whole time.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was thinking the whole time. And they would see that on a CT, but not necessarily an X-ray. So,
yeah, in fact,
kind of 5 years later,
they ended up saying he had a sub-detectable
hidden occlusion. Yeah, hidden occlusion is what they call it later in the story, but only after the fact. And they say it's like, you know, millions to one that it would occur, and there's no way they could have known. But I've got the portion here of him ending up in the hospital and then sort of getting that preliminary diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You know, so of course the birthday party was canceled. The child was in the hospital with a mild concussion and suffering from shock. There'd been vomiting, and his lungs had taken in fluid, which needed pumping out that afternoon. Now he simply seemed to be in a very deep sleep, but no coma, Dr. Francis had emphasized. No coma, when he saw the alarm in the parents' eyes. At 11 o'clock that night, when the boy seemed to be resting comfortably after many x-rays and lab work, it was just a matter of waking up and coming around. So,
does anybody believe this is a mild concussion?
even me as a layperson, but with, you know, a limited amount of knowledge of medicine just by exposure, none of that seemed right to me.
Well, even to the parents in the story.
The parents are real skeptical. Yeah. Yeah. He's just like, keeps putting them off. Like, no, it's fine. It'll be fine.
And I think it was really interesting that you brought this up too, because there's this sort of thought process where we think we can kind of find all the answers, or we can really get to the bottom of things with technology. But sometimes I get this feeling like in this story, you know, the doctor was hiding behind authority.
Right.
And now that's poo-pooed, and you can instead hide behind technology.
Right.
And sort of say, well, you know, the imaging says this, or the, you know, but da da da. And so sometimes it feels like just passing the buck.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are clearly going to be times where people, they don't know, they can't say for sure. But then there are also times where perhaps they don't want to go out on a limb and be potentially wrong.
Yeah. You don't want to be the doctor that was like, that somebody, you know, goes and tells their friends, the doctor said he had 6 weeks to live, and now it's 2 years later. Like, you don't want to be that doctor.
It's a quagmire. What do you say? So you can't offer false reassurance. You can't do the opposite of that. You also can't say, I don't know. Because then they're like, well, you must know.
And they beg. So, like, what are you supposed to
say? And it's hard, too, because I'm sure in this case in the story where this kid comes in, a lot of times they'll come in just like this and will be fine, maybe even the majority of time. So this right. very well, and what they make it sound like is the rare time. So even like what you're saying, Dylan, where if the doctor says, I don't know, and embraces the ambiguity, there very well be another doctor down the hall who's like, oh, no. 90% of the time we can say he'll be all right and it'll make the parents feel better. So then it kind of puts the doctor who's embracing the unknown and the ambiguity and makes him look worse. And
right.
it is causing potentially undue stress in the eyes of the parents. So it's hard.
This kind of goes back to a conversation that I've had a couple of times, and actually talked with somebody about this earlier this morning. Like, so it's about, no matter how you want to put it, authority or trust or whatever, how as a clinician do you build trust and or authority? And what are the tools that you have? Now, there are ways that you can do that where you're maybe telling half-truths or something like that. And many physicians over the years have made that choice. But then what about the physician who does choose to say, we're doing everything we can, we're really working hard on this, but right now we don't know. And if you look at the feedback that patients often give when asked how their experience was with their physician, whether it's in a clinical setting or if it's their primary care physician, they say, well, my physician doesn't seem to relate to me, or I didn't feel as though they were personally available or there for me. But I would venture to guess that the person who has the clinician who says, I don't know, but we're going to figure it out, and really makes themselves vulnerable in that way, that says to me that that's somebody who's going to build the trust of the patient through honesty.
Yeah.
And there are obviously, and have been over the years, varying schools of thought on how to do that. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about things like virtue, trust, maybe that's something to really be considered. And we see here in this story a pretty interesting example of how sort of hedging or trying to be overly confident maybe made a situation worse.
Yeah.
Certainly undermine the trust.
Right.
Yeah, because when it eventually comes out that, like, they're not going to be okay, this isn't going to get better, then you're like, oh, crap.
Right. Yeah, because then you've sort of set yourself up to seem incompetent on some level.
Put your foot in your mouth now.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that made me cringe the most is just the degree of the certainty that he always spoke with, like, speaking in absolute terms like that.
Yeah. I'll wake up any minute now.
Yeah,
I'm certain. I know it'll happen. It's
he's
just
like
how
willing,
it'll be.
He's like willing it to happen,
right?
Yeah, and it's the whole idea. You know, there's a description of how he's dressed and how
Not
he
God's.
Carries himself. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. I mean, there's that whole idea. He's wearing the sort of more formal attire with the white coat on top, mm-hmm. and that's always been that's a signifier of. You know, if you want to go archetypal, that's like, oh, he's the wizard.
Yeah.
The wizard is all-knowing, right?
Mm. Well, this isn't something that came about organically. I mean, doctors manufactured this for themselves, I think, for many years during sort of that golden age of medicine, mm-hmm. when a lot of new technologies and new cures were sort of exploding, and suddenly we could deal with all these things that people just had no idea 10 years before. And doctors, and also I think, you know, like the film industry, for example, like really contributed to this idea of doctors as like all-knowing, all-seeing gods.
Yeah.
But as we continue to learn more about medicine, that continues to be less and less the case and less sustainable as doctors have to know more things.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk in medical education about the doubling time of information that you need to know in order to be effective.
Yeah.
And you know, it gets to the point where it's exponential to where no one person could actually keep up with that. And so what we're trying, I think the transition that we're trying to make in medical education is, and the humanities are incredibly important in this, is to create new physicians through education that are not only able to memorize the stuff that's in the books and then pass the tests, but also build those skills that the humanities and liberal arts are so good at building, which is to learn how to learn and mm-hmm. continue to adapt as information continues to expand. So it's almost a paradigm shift, really, mm-hmm. between what a physician traditionally was and what a physician really needs to be now. But there's still these vestigial ideas that hang on. And it takes some soul searching to try and figure out what kind of physician mm-hmm. you're really going to be. No footsie,
sorry.
By the way, gentlemen.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. So, moving on in the story, I mean, it's at this point we're kind of set up for. I think everyone who reads the story, and it's difficult for me because I've read it many times. You recognize from that passage that we just read and discussed that things are not going to go well.
Right. I mean, you know? This was the first time I'd ever read it.
Yeah.
And
dramatic irony builds.
Yes.
Right. I kind of felt the same way I think the parents kind of felt, where it's like, I don't think this is going well.
It's like, yeah, maybe he should wake up now if that's all that there is. But and it goes on, you know. Then the next morning, the father comes back after going home to take a shower and feed the dog, and he's hooked up to an IV.
The dog's name is Slug.
The dog's name is Slug.
Yes. Yeah, that's worth
Classic.
Noting.
Yeah, easily the best noting. Part.
Yeah, which I think is great. And several things happen that kind of complicate this story. And from a writing standpoint, what makes writers like Carver really great is that they're embracing the convention of what a short story is, and so there are expectations from the reader. But then that's subverted and sort of chopped up in ways that make it more interesting and unexpected. And so naming the dog Slug is one of those moments that might pop you out of the story, but then it makes you draw back deeper in and be like, it gives a sort of verisimilitude mm-hmm. to it. These aren't just two-dimensional parent characters. They are people who would name their dog Slug, right?
Yeah.
So that to me was really interesting. Another interesting aspect that starts to develop around this time is that sort of the prelude to the story was the mother stopping several days before into a bakery to order her son a birthday cake. And it was a special order that had his name on it and everything else. And so as dad goes home, dad starts getting phone calls, you know, about this cake. Nobody picked up the cake.
But they don't say the cake. Yeah, they say Scotty. Well, because the cake has the name Scotty on it.
That was the most infuriating part of it for me, yeah. is how unclear the baker was. Which is an important part of it, really.
Here's the thing, though. When he talks to the dad, he does say cake.
Oh, he does.
He does.
But it's just the dad didn't know.
Yeah, the dad didn't make the connection.
Bring it up, because the dad had nothing to do with the cake purchasing process.
So the dad picks up the phone and there's a cake that wasn't picked up. The voice on the other end of the line says, "What are you saying?" Howard asked. "A cake," the voice said. "A $16 cake." So, and that's the only time that the caller mentions the cake. And if dad had relayed the information to mom that this guy was calling about a cake, what the hell is that all about? Then,
right.
you know, the rest of the story would have been, you know, tragic in the way that it obviously was, but it wouldn't have had that sort of ending that we're going to discuss. So, you know, mom goes home later and the calls continue, but there's no mention of the cake. And she's like totally freaked out. She thinks that, you know, someone's calling from the afterlife saying that she forgot about her son. Yeah,
or like the driver of the car is calling to like harass her.
Granted, the guy keeps calling and saying, "You forgot about Scotty," and then hanging up.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And that's,
I finally met someone in the story who's worse at the phone than I am. Like, finally, after all these years.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really kind of interesting. And later on in the story, we find out more about this baker character who, you know, it's pretty interesting the way it's brought out. Scotty continues to be unconscious. They continue to, you know, go back and forth. There's an interlude where the mother meets a family whose son had been stabbed, and that has a strange sort of, I mean, it very much deepens the sense of dread that you have, like, oh crap, this little boy is going to die, and now we've just had a vision of death. So there's a heavy dose of biblical foreshadowing and biblical archetypal, thematic elements that start to take over.
Yeah. It's also kind of like a nice, it's a patient experience and a patient, specifically a patient family experience, to meet other families in the hospital.
Right.
And like bond with them. And then, you know, you'll never see them again. But like that particular bond was a very special thing. Like I had that, my dad was really sick when I was younger. And I remember having like that kind of experience with other families. And I've never seen or heard from any of those people again. And I probably never will. But like there's something really unique about bonding while you're both trapped in a hospital.
Yeah. I had similar experiences during September 11th, like on the day of September 11th, living in New York City and just having these experiences with people, because you're thrown together into a situation that automatically breaks down all the barriers that you would traditionally have up with strangers. I thought that was an interesting way to sort of highlight the situation that the mother was in a certain way, but also give us that sense of intimacy and something that up to this point has been pretty cold and sort of filled with BS for the family.
Yeah.
So I think I remember, John, you writing something about an experience that you had that was maybe somewhat similar when your son was ill.
Yeah. It's one of those things that, you know, it lives in this sort of netherworld where you, when you experience it, you just know that it's happened, you know, and you, the profound sense. You know, it's that kind of sends that shiver down your spine. Right. I was walking in the hospital when my son was sick, and I saw another dad of another child just walking as well. And we had been walking, but basically like opposing direction loops. And we ran into each other once, and we just kind of looked at each other, and that sort of nodded, you know, and you could see, you get this whole depth of experience that there is that, you know, vulnerability of being there sort of against your will, thrown together into the circumstance, but also there's that sort of knowing where, you know, we're sort of accepting our helplessness or hopelessness in that, right, in that moment.
Yeah. And the family in the story is extremely different. You know, they refer to them as a Negro family, presumably dating the story a little bit. Yeah. But I mean, they're probably from a poorer neighborhood because, like, yeah, their kid got stabbed.
Yeah, there's a lot of underlying code as to like how and what is being said about the differences between the middle class white family and their experience, but then the universality that they have.
Yeah,
with
like, fate's gonna come get you no matter what.
Yeah, and just that those experiences don't have prejudice. You know, they don't differentiate themselves one from the other. So it's a really interesting interlude in the story that then, you know, takes us immediately back to the mom and her, you know, she's becoming increasingly afraid, and the phone calls continue. And it's like, you know, you forgot about Scotty, you know, what about Scotty? And these calls are coming at 5 a.m. there's
this guy's so weird.
So bad at the phone. Yeah, it's like, so bad.
But see, one thing that we come to understand later is that here's this baker who seems like a pretty darn evil dude, but at the same time, it gives us yet another slice of human reality in that he's just a guy who has been a baker for years and maybe has lost touch with how to be an interactive, caring person, because his interactions are often one-dimensional, like, here's your cake, lady, and nothing more. And so he gets ticked off when upper classy white person comes in and, you know, some soccer mom, I guess,
prank calls a pizza and basically, you know, and then doesn't pay for it, and he went to all the work to make it.
Yeah, so that's how we view him here in the first really 2/3 of the story, as this like pretty evil guy. But it kind of changes. I mean, so we get the death of Scotty, and I want to read this for at least for comparison and contrast between the description of the accident and the description of the death. So I think I've got it right here. Okay. So the parents are talking about how, well, tomorrow morning they're going to operate. They're going to check it out and see what's going on. And then the mother says, "Oh God," she said. "Oh, please, Howard, please." She said, taking his arms. "Look," Howard said. "Scotty, look." And he turned toward the bed. The boy had opened his eyes, then closed them. He opened them again now. The eyes stared straight ahead for a minute, then moved slowly in his head until they rested on Howard and Anne, then traveled away again. "Scotty," his mother said, moving to the bed. "Hey, Scott," his father said. "Hey, son." They leaned over the bed. Howard took the child's hand in his hands and began to pat and squeeze the hand. Anne bent over the boy and kissed his forehead again and again. She put her hands on either side of his face. "Scotty, honey, it's Mommy and Daddy," she said. "Scotty." The boy looked at them, but without any sign of recognition. Then his mouth opened, his eyes scrunched closed, and he howled until he had no more breath in his lungs. His face seemed to relax and soften then. His lips parted as his last breath was puffed through his throat and exhaled gently through his clenched teeth. there's so much more drama in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can almost see if we were sort of drawing a triangle of a plot line down into this moment, this is the end of that arc where this horrible thing is now happening, the thing that everyone had dreaded. And just, again, Carver's language that he chooses, he doesn't choose any real sort of over-the-top language. Really, the only thing that you could maybe say is...
Howl.
Yeah, that he howls.
Yeah, it took me a second to realize that he died there.
Me too.
Right.
I thought, oh, wow, he's up and now he's just in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
Last breath was in...
And that well, oh, but
I had
that's,
to, well, I had to kind of reread word. It. I skimmed over it. Yeah,
but that's how he drops it. He doesn't. He doesn't.
Right,
drop
that's really
it
the
in,
only
in,
bit
in any other way, such as to sort of catch you off guard with, well, this crazy thing that just happened out of the blue,
and he was
is
gone.
The end.
Yeah,
and I think you know there's a real poignance to that, having you know being in clinic and having actually seen death yesterday. And the context in which I saw that, there's a rawness to it that this kind of language and like Hemingway, you know, that this kind of very plain sort of, I'm just reporting the scene to you.
Right.
And then you're left to bring it all together.
Right.
So he does cheat there. He tells you it's the last breath. And in that sense, it gives you that sort of shell shock where you look at it and you're like, wait a minute, what did I just see? Did that really just happen?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And he pulls it like, so it's kind of, there are a couple of things that happen. Scotty opens his eyes, you know, just as they're discussing the surgery that might happen the next morning. And the parents obviously are reacting with excitement, like, oh, it's, you know, mm-hmm. it's happened. He's waking up. It's all over and we're safe. And then he pulls the rug out from under. But he does it in this sort of... In the hands of a different writer, it would have been much more dramatic, or at least what the focus of that scene would have been different.
You don't realize the rug is gone until they're on the floor.
Right. Right. And immediately following that paragraph that I just read, we change the scene entirely, and we go into exposition. The doctors called it... a hidden occlusion. So we've gone straight from extremely visceral life experience to here's the jargon that's supposed to distance us from it.
Mm-hmm. And you're looking, where's the parents' reaction?
Yeah.
Did that really happen?
Yeah.
And then it really takes your time to get to that. They go right to the technical term, like you were saying, and just explain the...
Yeah, so you know, Carver. This was one of his things that, you know, as one of the new realists of the period. You know, we're just coming out of the time in literature where people like Thomas Pynchon are writing things that are just, you know, way out in the nether regions of realistic fiction, if at all. And then Carver comes along with other folks and starts writing this really visceral, realistic fiction that's delivered with such incredible paucity of language, you know, just really, really stripped back, very plain language. And so, you know, the way that this unfolds, we then just get this experience of the parents sort of wandering dazed out of the hospital, having been told that their son needs to have an autopsy to find out what happened, and they just can't quite put their arms around what's going on. They go home and, you know, there's this toys, there's all this stuff, you know, it was this birthday. And how do you cope with that, the hole that's left there? Just really, really impactful. And Carver, once again, you know, he does the phone calls. And that sort of sends the mom over the edge. But it's a slow burn that he switches scenes again. And then it's much later, before midnight, when all of a sudden the mom is like, I know who that bastard is. And the way that we've been trained about the way that we experience narrative You know, like you were saying about TV doctors or lawyers or police officers, you know, these everyday heroes that, mm-hmm. that they portray on television shows. We now get a sense of, okay, now we're going to get like the avenging mother mm-hmm. who's, you know, going to go into this dramatic scene. And it is dramatic. They go to the shopping center.
She's going
to
bake him a pound cake. Is that what you're trying to say?
Oh!
That
coming in hot.
Yeah. Dylan, the man of few words, but well chosen.
I don't know. I think that was kind of half baked.
Oh, I love it.
Love oh, my. It.
Clever.
So, anyway.
There is something very like sacred and fiery about like a mom's
yeah.
wrath, and it's that, very like
yeah the avenging angel, you know. Yeah. It goes all the way back to, you know, things like my knowledge of Greek tragedy and that kind of thing is spotty at best, but you know, like Athena, you know, that sort of strong mother figure who's got all kinds of power. And so that's vested into this woman who has up to this point been a victim. So they drive to the shopping center where she ordered the cake. And she's like, there are times where, okay, so this is how she has her epiphany. If I could get my hands on him, it came to her then. She knew who it was. Scotty, the cake, the telephone number. She pushed the chair away from the table and got up. "Drive me down to the shopping center," she said. "Howard."
It's worth noting, too, that in the very beginning of the story, she already didn't like him because he was very curt with her.
Yeah, she was trying to be all buddy-buddy, and he was just like, okay.
And I think we all know those people who sort of go through life trying to have that experience of... And I don't fault them, but it's that sort of very surface level connection with people and
like all of Iowa, including me,
like all of
I
Iowa.
Do it all the time.
He only speaks with yeast. He's forgotten all of his English. Yeah. That's what I blame for the,
but you know, I can kind of, once we get to this point, I can kind of understand where he's coming from. Since I live in Iowa and I'm not from Iowa, and I've been here for 12 years, I get creeped out by like the overbearing kindness of strangers.
I've had conversations with people in two floors on the elevator.
Yeah.
Frequently. This isn't like a one, this is like all the time. All the time.
And see, I totally admire that until it happens to me, and then I'm like, why?
Like, yes, the weather's great.
You're really creeping me out, though, by talking to me and I don't know you. So be that as it may, she's now figured it out, and she's going to go take her pound of flesh. Sorry.
Dylan's was better,
but, you know. I find myself.
Well, you looked at me when you said that. I was like, "Uh oh." Well,
I don't even know
if there's a pound here.
I was using your word, and so I wanted to like sort of give you ocular credit.
Ocular credit.
Can they see that?
That's the title of this
Can
episode.
Can you guys see that on Facebook? Okay, so we get to this scene, and this is the scene that defies what our expectations are of the story. Because here's mom; she's ready to kick some butt and really tell this guy off. And they pound on the door. The baker lets them in. And at first he's standoffish. He's like, "Oh, you're here for the cake. You want to pick up this 3-day old cake? It's not good to anybody now.
It's midnight. You really want it?"
Yeah. And then she says, "My son's dead." She said with a cold, even finality. "He was hit by a car Monday morning. We've been waiting with him until he died. But of course, you couldn't be expected to know that, could you? Bakers can't know anything, can they, Mr. Baker? But he's dead. He's dead, you bastard." And this is the turn. Like, we've already had multiple moments throughout the story that we think could be the big moment, but it's left to this point. And instead of escalating the situation, the baker is suddenly infused with a realization about himself and the experience. And he says, please sit down. Let me get you a chair. Sit down now, please. The baker went into the front of the shop and returned with two little wrought iron chairs. Please sit down, you people. And the mother says, I wanted to kill you. I wanted you dead. And the baker goes on to say, let me say how sorry I am. He's putting his elbows on the table. God alone knows how sorry. Listen to me. I'm just a baker. I don't claim to be anything else. Maybe once, maybe years ago, I was a different kind of human being. I've forgotten. I don't know for sure how, but I'm not any longer if I ever was. Now I'm just a baker. And that brings into relief this idea of quiet lives of desperation, right? Each of us in some way leads that kind of life where our external life is just a baker. Our internal life, which we may lose somewhere along the way, is or was something different. And he's seeing this now for the first time. It's almost like a convergence, you know, and he's sort of come back to a place that he hadn't been for a long time.
Well, he probably tries to not think about, like, how lonely he is or, like, how little is going on in his life except the day in and day out of bakering.
Right, and...
Baking?
Baking?
Bakering. How dare you?
But the thing about it is, like, now we come back to this thing about, as we talked about earlier with the job of a physician, which is, you know, can be many things. You know, is it the 15-minute session and then moving on to the next patient as sort of automatically as the baker moves through each day baking these cakes that will have tons of meaning to the people who then partake of them, but they don't mean anything to him.
Yeah, and he's kind of on the outside. He's really lonely and, like, just engaged in his job 100% of the time. And, like, his job is watching other people's celebrations.
Right.
And, like, facilitating other people's lives.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad analogy for a doctor, if right. you think about it. Like, we're very much external and seeing little snippets of people's lives and, like, facilitating parts of it. But they go home at the end of the day and we stay at the hospital for freaking ever.
And I think that there's two things about that. One, I'm glad you said bakering, because I think baking is an act. Right? No, okay.
Right, you're gonna being the
so,
baker.
But thank you. Bakering is in that sense, we're appropriating it, you know? We're giving it this notion that the one who does all the baking becomes in and of itself this different entity, right? Yeah. You've mm-hmm. subsumed this vertical identity of your job, your
right.
You can bake at home, you can't become a baker at home.
Right. And right, it's
so far.
But the thing is,
what brings that into my personal experience, you know, is just yesterday we had a very, very traumatic and horrible thing that had happened, and you know, I was listening to varying different viewpoints on it from different providers and different, you know, nurses and staff members and stuff, and you know, lots of people were saying, well, this went on for too long, or we did too much, and it became kind of clear to me that people have forgotten the fact that, you know, because they do it so often, and maybe to protect themselves, or maybe just out of sheer loss of perspective, that, you know, it may be very common for you to, you know, run a cardiac arrest and see this bad outcome, but that family is seeing it the first time. That's the only one they'll ever live. That's the only time that child of theirs is going to die. Yeah. You know, in that sense, like you've lived in this identity for so long that you forget what it's like to be that person on the outside who actually has to see the raw reality of their dead child.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it normalizes for you. Like, every day in your job, you go to your job, certain things happen, they become commonplace because of their normalization. And so I always say to students when I'm talking about this kind of thing, like, you know, what may be another day at the office for you may potentially be the worst day of your patient or their family's lives. And on one hand, you can't allow yourself to feel that emotion every day, but you can't allow yourself to become desensitized to the point where you don't recognize it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think everyone says you can't allow yourself to feel that emotion. And I
think you can.
Yeah, I
think
question
that's
that.
That's a false.
Well, I question that.
Well, they're saying you can't try and experience it to the extent that the family's experiencing it
right.
every day.
Yeah. Right. True. Right.
But it's a balance, is what people are getting at.
But I think they use it as an argument to not as an argument to balance at all, but you're as an argument to sort of either turn it on its side, turn it on its head, or ignore it outright.
Yeah. Right.
And I think you're using it as, in a sense, to strike a balance. But I think, you know, typically what people are doing when they say that is like, no, don't cry here. You know, and it's sort of like the accidental, unspoken critique of handing someone a tissue.
Right.
When someone's upset and, you know, their child has died, handing someone a tissue is incidentally a way of saying shut up. You know, it's time to stop crying.
But I
see
what you're getting at.
It's not intentionally, but I think that that's absolutely part of the social connotation of that is this is the thing that you do when you're done crying. This is the thing that you have, you know, and so you see things like that that are not, I mean, it's certainly not intentional that I think
I mean,
that people
I mean,
do
no
that.
One, no one wants to have like snot dripping down their face, like when they're in like a like really harrowing situation.
But, I don't know if you're really in the harrowing situation, that even crosses your mind.
Oh, it does. It does for me.
That's because she is an Iowan. That talks to everybody.
What? Hey, no, like
don't
just
the push
sensation
the
of
live button. Gotta go to my meeting.
You don't want it on forever.
All right, we've lost our engineer. No, everything's gonna fall off the rails now. But
this is how it ends.
Here's the thing about what you guys are saying is true, and I think what happens is the good intentions of something like handing someone a tissue then becomes a rote action. Right? Yeah. That becomes sort of codified into the this is how you do this and you know, maybe you aren't trained to do that. But it's one of those things.
We just had a lecture about like motivational interviewing and she was like, yeah, you know, you want to like affirm the person's feelings, but not too much. You can't just sit there all day and affirm people's feelings. It's gotta be genuine, because otherwise they'll be like, we know you're just full of it. But like how do you it's hard to be that genuine all the
And the goal of motivational the goal of motivational interviewing is to allow somebody to own a space enough to bring themselves into it, as opposed to forcing them into the space, right?
So
you can't just keep, you know, you've only got so much rope to pull them in, and then you've got to let them experience the situation. And so, and really, I think that's a lot of what we've got in these last few paragraphs of the story. We have made this transition between people who live in a world where they have their silos that keep them separated to a real moment of presence. Mm-hmm. You know, the baker has had his convergence. And the portion that has blown me away since I was 19 years old of this story is when the baker says, "You probably need something to eat. I hope you'll all eat some of my hot rolls. You have to eat and keep going. Eating is a small good thing in a time like this." Mm. You know, and
he's not wrong.
Exactly. I mean, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be eating, but the act of eating is now, and this is where it gets sort of heavily biblical, right?
Mm-hmm.
This idea of, you know, the body and the blood and the whole idea of keeping things going. You know, eating is fuel. Fuel is motion forward. But it's also, I mean, where do we find communion in our society? Sitting around the table, mm-hmm. and communing with those that are closest to us. Those are the biggest celebrations of our culture, Thanksgiving, et cetera, et cetera. So he's recognized this very powerful totem of eating. and it's the gift that he has to give. And he's recognized that as a baker, I'm not just facilitating other people's celebrations. As a baker, on my best days, I can bring together people and be a part of their communion through my works.
Yeah. And they do talk about, like, the whole story. They're like, oh, we just have no appetite. Like, that's a thing that is said
right.
several times.
Yeah. So it's, to me, it starts out as sort of a after-school special kind of, you know, tragedy, be careful, kids, when you walk into the road, look both ways kinds of thing. That's the trappings of it. That's the trappings of it. But as it goes and as it builds and as the writer really sort of refracts events off of one another, it becomes something about what it means to be together and present as human beings. Mm-hmm. And presence is something that we talk about a lot as we talk about what physicians should strive to do or think about as part of their duty. Is you can't always give the pill that cures the disease. Sometimes you can only be present and available for those who are not going to make it through what they're struggling with. Mm-hmm. But our culture is always about solving problems, right?
Yeah.
So this is the differential diagnosis. These are the things that happen here. So the course of action is X.
Well, that's why talking about palliative care suddenly becomes a death panel.
Right. Right.
Even though it's a hugely important thing and people just won't talk about it.
Right. And I think that culture is and probably will continue to change where palliative care is going to be one of the largest aspects of medicine. It's growing because we're living longer, but that doesn't mean we won't have more and more need for care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I read this story, and I don't know how you guys feel, but as I walk away from it, I feel the tragedy of the situation, but I also feel like an incredible amount of hope for humanity in just that moment in the bakery.
Yeah, I feel like the end is kind of the raison d'etre for the whole thing.
Right.
I wasn't really on board until that last part. But do you feel like the cake and the boy are kind of the same thing in a way? I thought there was an interesting parallel, just how like, you know, cake is something sweet, and then you eat it, and then it's gone, you know?
Right.
And so kind of like reflecting the you know, transient nature of life.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to be death. It can just be, you know, being a father, watching my daughter grow from 5 years old to 13 now. It's
right,
like,
that person is not there anymore.
Right.
Yeah,
and I keep trying to tell her to get smaller again.
Does that work at all?
It doesn't work. It doesn't work at all.
You know, my dad told me that once, and I was like, I don't know, I was not very old. And I was like, I have to keep growing or I'll die. He never said it again.
Yeah, my daughter says similar things. She's like, I can't stop it. I can't not, I have to keep going. I'm a teenager now. You just have to deal with it.
And you're like, that's deeper than you realize. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like, right in the existential crisis.
Yeah, damn. Maybe it's because I want to get smaller again. Mm. Or at least younger. But I think Dylan brings up a good point, though. I mean, the life of the cake and the life of the boy run parallel through the first half of the story. And so it's like, what do you do when something is no longer there, you know, whether it's a spoiled cake or your child has died? How do you move on? And the answer here is to continue to sustain yourself and to have communion with other people around you. It's just, you know, really fascinating story. And I will say that there is another version of this story, an earlier version of this story, where mom gets in the bathtub and they've been getting these harassing phone calls. Mom gets in the bathtub, phone rings, and that's the end of the story.
What?
Yeah.
That's a terrible story.
Exactly.
Well,
I mean, it's a different story.
It's different.
It's a different story that speaks to, like, how you... There are things beyond your control, and there's always, like, another monster behind the next door. And you can't stop it. Like, that's that story is that, as opposed to this much more nuanced and sort of explored.
The person driving the car was the husband. Yeah. Like, you can go so many.
Yeah.
The people are cakes making humans.
There's a ghost cake now.
So, I mean, I think we've probably gone on for long enough to lose our engineer.
long enough to lose our audience, too.
Probably so. But
what audience?
But this is the thing. I mean, one thing that I enjoy so much about reading and writing with you guys as students and all the other students that I work with is that we have these conversations about the stories that we read or that we create that really beg questions that are super important. And I don't know if the answers to those questions are the same in different kinds of classes. So I just really like to explore these things in the way that we do here, because it is all applicable to everyone else's life. That's why stories resonate with people. Mm-hmm. They can see themselves in them.
And at least for doctors, it's far too easy to become just a baker or like just a doctor and not a person at all.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, I finally gave my friend her Christmas present, and she got some of my other friends, like my partner, she got some stuff from the con that she just went to, and she comes back and I was like, oh, where's my present? And she was like, oh, I didn't know what to get you because like all you do is medical school. And like my heart just like shattered into a million pieces.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not about getting a stupid button from an anime con that I probably wouldn't care about anyway. It's that I've been friends with you for 3 years and you can't think of one thing that I might enjoy that's not related to medicine. Like that, like either I'm doing something wrong or she's doing something wrong. And like,
here, let me make this simple for you. It's her.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, because honestly, she's probably a little frustrated or feeling insecure about the fact that you have something that she isn't involved in that has grown in its importance and in the scope of your life. And so she feels insecure about the
fact. Watch her be like our one viewer right now. Oh. Like, oh my God.
Oh my God.
How dare.
Well, I mean, hey.
This is what you get if you don't get me a button.
I demand satisfaction.
You know, that sort of passive aggression is uncool.
But I don't know. It just makes you
word,
wonder, though,
man.
Like, is med school the only thing that I talk about? You know, like, and I know that is a thing that happens, especially when med students get together. All they talk about is medicine, and it's hard to.
It's easy.
You have to work.
It's easy to work around.
You have
you
to
just need
you
the
have to work
right
to-
party favors.
Mm. Well.
Oh, I need to go to the party they're going to.
No.
All right, let's keep it. Let's keep it PG-13 here.
We're still there.
Yep.
We're still there.
Yep.
I've
heard Disney movies dirtier than this.
We wear the best hats at our parties, and that's what breaks all the ice. The best party favors.
Dylan loves hats.
As the ghost of Christmas future, I will tell you guys that parties cease to exist, and all you do is go home to your house and get up the next day. And
I'm going to live in the forest.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is why I'm not having children.
Jason, you realize I do have two children. I know this already.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's
your standard of what party changes dramatically.
Well, yeah, but then like you increasingly lose the ability to partake in the things that once were central to partying.
Like great hats. I don't have the hair for a great hat anymore.
Maybe
guys.
Maybe I need hats.
You need a hat with hair in it.
Okay, so
ooh, no, those are very itchy. I've tried,
like,
I've tried, guys.
Like the visor with the fake hair.
Oh my God!
So anyway, okay, this is starting to go.
Dave's got. Do we need Dave to
fast.
Shut us down?
Dave, help! We're helpless.
So we'll use this moment to begin to wrap up. Anybody who might have possibly been listening to this and got to this point, I want to offer you some sort of prize. So get in touch with me.
It's a hat or a cake.
It would be a hat or a cake, and I promise that the secret
word you use when you get a hold of Jason is hat cake.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that.
I promise that the cake will be mostly fresh.
The cake is not a lie.
But and it won't say Scotty on it.
Thanks for being here, folks. You know, thanks to Dave for engineering for us and helping us out. Dylan, Casey, John, Mark, thank you for being a part of the conversation. I am the executive producer of this program as well as the host and all things this show, I guess.
Hi, Duke.
And this show has been sponsored by a generous donation from the department that I run. So this has been Not Gods or Machines, a conversation about medicine and the humanities. And until the next time, thanks for being here.